Welcome, folks. We're going to make a start. Is this on? Yep. Very warm welcome to St. Peter's Barge. My name is Marcus Nodder. I'm the senior minister here. If you're here for the first time, you are especially welcome. And welcome to this One Thing in Common event. This is part of a series, One Thing in Common, where we get different people from different walks of life, different backgrounds, who have one thing in common, which is their faith in Jesus Christ. And we interview them, find out a bit about them, and then there's going to be a short talk, which today will be on meeting the risen Jesus. Now, our guest today used to work here in Canary Wharf, so had 20 years in senior management at Credit Suisse, and then went on to become the first non-family head of Hoare & Co., which is the UK's oldest private bank. Would you please welcome Jeremy Marshall? So, Jeremy, welcome. Tell us back to your old stomping ground here. What's it like at the top? What's it like up there?
No, I really enjoyed it. It was great fun. Nice to see Credit Suisse in the newspapers again. Right. When you're in a senior role in company, of course there is pressure and stress and unpleasant things. The most unpleasant thing is obvious. It's having to fire people. But it's also fun. It's interesting. And I spent 15 years outside the UK in Switzerland, France and the States. That was great fun.
I guess some people who are sort of further down the food chain probably look up and think, if only I could get to those dizzy heights and have that kind of money coming in and that status, then everything would be sorted. What was your experience having been up there and the sort of peer group you were mixing with?
Yeah. Well, look, I'm 56 and I think when I started in the city, which I believe a lot was 1984, if I think back to in my early 20s, we all pretty much thought that if you made a lot of money and you got, power and authority, that then you'd be really happy. But that's a mirage. If you go in the desert, sometimes people are desperate for a drink and they see this oasis and they get there and it's just a mirage, right? So it's a mirage in the city, and the mirage is that having lots of money or having power will make you happy. It doesn't. I can tell you both from people I've worked with in senior positions, and also I was in wealth management, so what do you spend your time with? Very wealthy people. And many of the wealthiest people in the world are profoundly unhappy. Often money is toxic and it kind of destroys people's families. I can think of a guy I liked and respected a lot who was CEO of one of Switzerland's biggest banks, and I saw him for breakfast, just the two of us, and a few days later he committed suicide. And it's a lie. It doesn't matter. Having lots of money, having success doesn't make you happy. And lots of friends of mine who have got to my advanced age, they're saying, well, is that it? Is that it? I've spent all my life, I worked all these hours, often I wrecked my marriage, and for what? I've got a lot of money, but it hasn't made me happy.
And did you think there was any, did you find any conflict between being a Christian and being a banker?
Only about once an hour, right? Yeah. I think the biggest conflict is really the conflict within us. And sometimes in companies, of course, you get asked to do things, or in fact, you do things that are wrong and the compliance department shows up or whatever. But actually, the biggest conflict is in your own heart. Solzhenitsyn, who some of you have heard of, who was 20 years in the Russian gulag, said the line between good and evil doesn't run between nations or between classes or between individuals. It runs down the middle of each one of us. So the basic problem I would say I had as a banker is not so much the bad things that other people were doing as the bad things I'm doing. And as a Christian, the temptation is, to worship money, right? Jesus said you can't serve both God and money. So even as a Christian, even if we're trying to live for God, money is powerful and it's a big temptation.
So you were there sort of riding the crest of the wave and then suddenly wiped out pretty spectacularly. Tell us how that came about.
Yeah, so 7 years ago, I felt a little lump on my rib like a pea when I was in the shower. And eventually it was diagnosed at the Marsden. They said it's a rare type of cancer called a sarcoma, which is cancer of the muscle tissue. Then I went through all kinds of treatment. And after about a year, they said, okay, you're fine now. And then you go for checkups. And I don't know quite how it happened, but anyway, 3 years later, so 4 years ago, another time I felt a lump, but this time it was a massive lump like a golf ball here on my collarbone. And I went back to the Marsden, and I can remember the day, 13th of June 2015, And they said, look, you've got tumours everywhere, all over your body, and there's nothing we can do. We can't cure you. And obviously, of course, the next thing you ask is, well, how long have I got? And they said, well, 18 months. But as you can see, they were wrong, right? Here I am, and I'm very happy to be alive. But that's been tough. I've been through, I've had 24 chemotherapies, about a dozen operations, radiotherapy, experimental therapies. I've also had major problems with my eyes. I lost sight in both eyes. I got it back in this eye, but I can't see anything out of that eye. So if you read about a kind of hospital crisis in London, it's my fault. I'm blocking all the beds in all the hospitals, yeah.
What's it like getting that kind of diagnosis? I mean, you've got a wife, you've got three kids.
Yeah, it's really hard. I'd say being told that is like being punched in the face. And when I was told that, I burst into tears. My wife was sitting next to me. Please don't think I'm some kind of, you know, super person or like amazing Christian. I'm not. I'm afraid. I don't want to die. I'd rather live. And death is fearful. Even as a Christian, where I believe there's something amazing beyond the grave, the actual process of dying, and I've been at my father's or my mother-in-law, both died of cancer, and it's ugly and messy. So, it's hard. The hardest thing is to have to go home from the hospital and tell your children. Yeah, that's very hard, and because it upsets them, right? You don't want to upset people you love. But at the same time, in the middle of that fear and mess and suffering, I've found overwhelmingly powerful the presence of God. And as I'm wheeled into the operating theatre for the next operation, I remember God's promises. For example, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Look, I'm with you always, even to the very end of the age. Or maybe the most famous chapter in the Bible, the 23rd Psalm. Yes, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. So God's promises give me strength, give me hope. And those promises are available to you. Please, it's not because I'm some kind of... People always say to me, I'm not religious, as if somehow I'm religious. I'm not inherently religious. I don't think anybody is. All I would say is I've found an answer to death. I know that's a big claim, right? I had the compliance department come running. Can't say that. No. Disclaimers. No, I really have found the answer to death, which is a person, Jesus Christ.
And what's your story of how you came to faith in Christ and why are you still a Christian today?
Yeah, why am I still a Christian today? Because God's holding me. That's what being a Christian is about. It's not about us holding God. It's about God holding us. How did I become a Christian? I grew up in a strongly Christian family. I had to go to church. I thought it was incredibly boring. I'd rather be anywhere else, sorry, Marcus, than a church. And one day I met Jesus Christ. I don't mean I had some, vision or something, no. But I felt a warmth within me. We're going to talk about that in the passage. I felt there's a reality that it wasn't just a dusty old document, but actually Jesus was alive now. And then, of course, there was also an element of a process in it. And I think most people who become a Christian, it's a process thing where we move from A to E to E to G and so on and so on. And we end up at Z, which is the destination, which is where we say, okay, Jesus, you're alive, you're God, I believe in you. But that process, with most people in a way, takes a period of time and did with me.
And if someone who is sceptical said, well, it's just wishful thinking, your hope of life beyond the grave, how would you respond to that?
I think it's a great question and a very fair one. Because the second most important question is facing death, and friends, we're all going to die, right? Any of you think you're immortal, I can sell you some life insurance afterwards, right? No, we're not immortal. Benjamin Franklin said we can escape everything in life except death and taxes. You're right, yeah. Having worked for Credit Suisse, sorry, Adrian, I can say that's not altogether true, right? Sure. All Credit Suisse clients are fully up to date with their tax affairs, but anyway. But we can't escape death, right? So, of course, it's helpful facing death to have that hope that there's something beyond the grave, that hope that Jesus conquered death. But that's not the most important. The most important question I submit to you is this. Is it true? Is it true? Otherwise, it is wishful thinking. Otherwise, it's just, well, yeah, what's the alternative? Kind of annihilation and oblivion. So is it true? I believe with all my heart it is true. And by the way, when you have a very serious disease, incurable disease, that's an acid question, right? Because I was a Christian before this. But the question then came to my mind do I believe it? And yes, I do believe it. And the reason I believe it is I believe the evidence that Jesus rose from the dead is overwhelmingly in favour that he did. Now, can I prove that 100%? No. But ultimately, it's difficult to prove anything, right? How do you know we all weren't just imagined into existence 5 minutes ago and given memories? So I believe that the historical evidence that Jesus rose from the dead is overwhelmingly strong. And we're going to look at that in a minute.
Final question, what do you spend your time doing then at the moment?
Well, I like suffering, so as you can see, so I'm a supporter of Watford, right? So that's like adding suffering on suffering, isn't it? I managed to avoid the 8-0, but I didn't avoid the 6-0 cup final. So yeah, I guess that's probably good for my character. And I love doing this kind of thing. I go round and chat about the Bible. Also, I've got about 15 friends that I like to just chat with about the Bible using this. This is just a little notes on John's Gospel. So I ask my friends, do you fancy having a chat about the Bible? And quite a few of them say yes. So we just sit down in coffee shops and talk about it. I try and answer their questions.
And you found time to write a book as well?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Marcus. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, good one. Sadly, I'm not expecting to earn a penny from it, but too bad. So it's called Beyond the Big Sea. Comes out in about 2 weeks and published by 10 of those. And it's an expanded version of this. It's my story of what it's like to go through cancer. Some of the experiences I've skipped over in more detail. And yeah, on what basis do we have hope? Because each one of us has to die, right? The Bible says it's given to man once to die and after that, the judgment. So death is a very real thing. And that's my question to you. Where's your hope in the face of death? And if you'd like to be given or get the book, that I think will give you the answer.
Now, you're going to explain a bit more about the basis of your hope in the face of death from Luke's Gospel. So inside your sheets there is a passage that Jeremy's going to read and then speak on.
Great. So this is one of the four eyewitness accounts, and this is by a man called Luke. That very day, which is the day of the resurrection, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about all the things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, when they didn't find his body, they came back saying they had seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. And he, that's Jesus, said to them, 'Oh, foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?' Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He acted as if he was going further, but they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, for it's towards evening and the day is now far spent.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. Their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?' And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. They found the 11, that's the 11 disciples, and those who were with them gathered together, saying, 'The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. As they were talking about these things, Jesus himself stood among them and said, 'Peace to you.'" First point. The only thing that can account for the resurrection is that it actually happened. And the reason that I say that is that because the disciples were so useless, right? And by the way, Christians are useless. Please don't think we're some kind of super being. No, we're not. We're useless too. These disciples, they all ran away when Jesus was arrested. And these two disciples, it's probably Cleopas and Mrs. Cleopas. And if it was Mrs. Cleopas, she was there, we know from another eyewitness account, at the crucifixion. They were going away, right? They'd given up. It's hopeless. Let's get out of Jerusalem before we are arrested. And yet, these same beaten, defeated, depressed, at the end of their tether disciples, within a few weeks, were standing in the middle of Jerusalem saying, Jesus Christ has risen. And a few months, a year later, some of them were being executed for that. So what possible logical explanation can there be for this incredible U-turn, this revolution and transformation from defeated, demoralized disciples to people willing to bet their lives that Jesus had really risen from the dead? I suggest to you, the only explanation is that indeed it did happen. And Christianity rises or falls on this claim that Jesus really came back from the dead. If it's not true, we're wasting our time here. Back to work. But I happen to believe it is true. Now, secondly, what are these disciples like? Friends, they're full of doubts, aren't they? They're full of doubts. They have the evidence staring them in the face, right? They should probably listen to women. We should all do that more, shouldn't we? Moreover, some women of our company amaze us, right? So the women had told the men, this is a patriarchal society, right? He's risen, but they didn't believe him. You would think they might walk a half a mile and actually check it out for themselves, right? It wouldn't have taken long. You would think, no, they hadn't done that at all. They hadn't even bothered to look into it. They're going away. So they're full of doubts. They're full of questions. They're in a way cynical, aren't they? Yeah, we thought it was going to happen, but yeah. And that we're cynical, aren't we, often at work? I think if you're going to survive in the war for the city, you have to be a bit cynical. But what's amazing is, one, that they are full of doubts, they are full of questions, but two, Jesus draws alongside them. Jesus draws alongside them. Look at the passage. Jesus himself drew near and went with them. So they're walking along, oh dear, it's terrible. They're thinking like, I'm going to be fired. You know, I'm going to be moved to Dublin or whatever the worst thing that can happen in Brexit is. Oh dear, life is terrible, isn't it? And suddenly, here comes Jesus and he draws alongside them. And friends, he draws alongside you this afternoon. He draws alongside you. Now, what do we see about Jesus' character? He's so full of patience and love, right? You would think that he might say, this is ridiculous. I've had these people with me for 3 years. They can't even believe it, the evidence in the face. Like Alan Sugar, you're fired. You're all fired. I'm going to get a new lot of disciples to start all over again. No, he's so patient. And friends, he's so patient with us, right? He's so patient. The Bible says God doesn't want anyone to perish. He doesn't want anyone to perish, to be separated eternally from him. He wants everyone to come to faith in him. So God is incredibly patient. And Jesus, who Christians believe is God, is incredibly patient. And he comes alongside them. And he brings them the reality of what happened. He opens their eyes. In this passage, three times things are opened. Their eyes, their mind, and Jesus opens the scriptures. And that's my next point. How do they meet Jesus? Jesus might just say, hi, it's me, I'm risen. No, he doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't do that because that's not the normal way he works. And there's a kind of transition going on here because Jesus was with these people, but he's not here. We can't see him. He's not going to walk through the door now. So how do we know if he's real? How do we know if it's true? Well, because of God's word. And that's what Jesus does. He gives them a little study, doesn't he? Verse 27. Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted them in all the scriptures concerning himself. So what's the Bible about, friends? The Bible, if you like, is the Christian prospectus. 66 books, 1,500 years, roughly, it covers. And obviously the Greek, the New Testament part, hadn't been written at that point. But they still had the 40-odd books of the Hebrew scriptures. And what's the subject of the Bible? It's Jesus Christ. In the Hebrew scriptures, the Jewish Bible, there are promises made that there will be a Messiah coming and that Messiah will bring us back to God. And the New Testament, the Greek Bible, that's the promises delivered that Jesus is here and that he's risen from the dead. Now, what does he need to teach them? He needs to teach them this. Verse 26, was it not necessary that Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? You see, what were they expecting? They were looking for a political answer, right? Now, does this sound at all familiar? We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yeah, get rid of those rotten Romans. We want Israxit, right? No Brexit, Israxit. These were Brexit party supporters, right, of their day. If only we can get rid of the Romans, then we'll be fine. Now, maybe some of you think, yes, that's quite right. If we can only get rid of the wretched EU, we'll be fine. And others are thinking the exact opposite, right? You're thinking, if only we could stay in the EU, it'll be fine. But probably most of you, because you're in the city, don't really care about politics. What you care about is money, right? You think, if only my boss would recognise what a genius I am and double my pay or give me a bigger job, if only I could be a managing director, then I would be happy. But Jesus says, no, that's not your biggest need. And that's what he says to you. Your biggest need is not money, promotion, relationships, or anything like that. Our biggest problem is this, that our relationship with God is broken. And why is it broken? It's broken because of the things that are wrong within us. The sin, the things that we've done wrong. Each of us, I absolutely include myself, and you could probably find some people in Credit Suisse who would confirm it, have done things that are wrong, right? Have done things that are wrong. We've treated people in a wrong way. And each of us has a burden, the sin and the things that have broken our relationship with God. And what we see as a characteristic of that, friends, is restlessness. And you see that very often in the city. People are restless. Because they're looking for something. And they think, if only I could get a pay rise. If only I had enough to buy a Ferrari. And then once you have a Ferrari, I can tell you, because I've seen this movie before, then you say, I've only had a yacht. If only I had a yacht, then I would be happy. Oh, now I've got a yacht. You think, I need a Gulfstream, right? No. People are never happy. That's the human condition, right? And these people, Cleopas and the other person, Jesus says, no, you've got it wrong. What's necessary is not all these things. What's necessary is that the Christ should suffer. So why is it necessary that Christ should suffer? Because sometimes people think about Jesus like Mozart, right? Mozart died very young in his 30s. If only Mozart had lived another 5 years, he wrote 41 symphonies, right? To show you how cultured I am. He could have written another 10 or another 15 piano concertos or whatever. What a tragedy. People can think like that about Jesus. But this is the Christian claim, friends. The Christian claim is this, that Jesus came to die. That tiny baby that we remember at Christmas, that's the Creator God becoming a human being, and he lived 33 years. Why? To die. Why did he have to die? Because on the cross he took our sins, all the things that we've done wrong, all the evil that's within us, all the things that break our relationship with God, all the things that make us restless. I mean, we're always looking for something we can't find. We're looking to go home and we can't go home. And where's home? Home is God, and we can't get back to God. But Jesus says, oh, that's mine. I'll take the bill for that. I'll pay the price. I'll die. So the key central lesson that they have to learn is the centrality of the cross. That's why the Christian symbol is a cross, right? It's a cross because on the cross we see God is reconciling the world. God is putting things right that were wrong. Now, let's go on. They drew near to the village to which they were going. He acted as if he were going further, but they urged him strongly, saying, stay with us, for it's towards evening and the day is now far spent. Then when he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. When you break bread, right, what do? You go like that, right? So what did they see? They probably saw the nail holes in his wrists, right, where he'd been fixed to the cross. And then they said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us? While he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures, and they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. So my last couple of points is this. What's becoming a Christian like? It's like having a heart transplant and it's like doing a U-turn. Not at the same time, right? Two different analogies of the same thing. So why do we need a heart transplant? Well, look what their hearts were like to start with. Jesus says to them, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. And after they've met Jesus, and how do they meet him? They meet him through his word. What happens to them? That their hearts are defrosted, right? If you go home, I'm sure all of you love cooking. I hate it. But anyway, you get a ready meal, right? And you put it in the microwave. If you try and eat the ready meal before it's in the microwave, it's hopeless. You can't do that. You put it in the microwave and it defrosts, right? So that's what the Bible tells us. Our hearts are cold, they're hard, they're full of evil, they're full of love of money, they're full of bad thoughts about other people. Do you think if our colleagues could see what we were thinking about them, they'd love it? I don't think so. No, sorry. Maybe you're all very virtuous, but not in my case, anyway. And what we need is a new heart. The heart in the Bible is the repository of what we're like, our true character, the real Jeremy, the real you. And we need a heart transplant. We need a new nature. We need God to come with us and unfreeze, microwave our hearts, right? And how does that happen? That happens when we meet Jesus. That's what being a Christian is. It's meeting Jesus Christ. We may know all the evidence for his death and resurrection, but if we don't know him now, not know about him, but know him, then we will not come to the heart of the Christian faith. But when we do meet him, especially when we look at his word, and I would say if you've got doubts or you're cynical, you've got questions, please ask a Christian friend. Could we have a look at the evidence? I'm not asking you to believe in something that's not true. I'm just asking you to look at the evidence. And the reason that's important is this. Outside Christ is only death, including eternal death, which is separation from God. Inside Christ, with Christ, is life, life eternal. That's what Jesus said, I've come to give life. Jesus said, I'm the resurrection and the life. So first of all, what's becoming a Christian like? It's like having a new heart. It's like having a heart transplant, and we need that. And when we do, when we experience God, by the way, we want more. What do? They say, stay with us, right? To start with, they're going away, but after their hearts begin to defrost, then they say, oh no, we want more. And if you come to some experience of Jesus, you'll want more. That's what I want. I want more of Jesus. I want more experience of him. Because in the face of death, there's nowhere else to go. Now, what's the second thing? They do a U-turn, right? Did any of you read about that snooker player, Australian snooker player? Anyone read that? Who was going to Barnsley to play in a snooker tournament? Anybody read that? No, you're too busy to read the paper. Yeah, he went to Barnsley in Gloucestershire, right? Yeah. So imagine you're this snooker player, you're driving along, and you think, well, I thought, you know, even Australians must have some idea of geography, right? Any Australians here? No, okay, that's good. We can make jokes about Australians. Then good. Okay, so, and suddenly you realise, oh my goodness, I'm due in Barnsley, Yorkshire, and I'm in Barnsley, Gloucestershire. So what do you do? I know it's not quite a U-turn, but you certainly would turn around if you're on the M4 and come back, right? So we must do the same, because by nature we're going away from God. We're going to be separated from God. We're alienated from God. We're under God's judgment, and we're going away from him. But the wonderful news is God doesn't leave us in our ignorance to go the wrong way. No, he comes alongside us and he says, don't go that way, because the end of that road is death and destruction. Come back home. Come back to me. And that's what they do, isn't it? They rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 disciples and those who were with him gathered together, saying, the Lord has risen indeed and appeared to Simon. So my last point, my children tell me you must stop doing this, having in conclusion and in last point. Okay, this is the last point, is you need to meet Jesus. You need to meet him. You need to meet him. How can you meet him? You can meet him if you look at what he writes to you. That's what the Bible is. It's really a letter from God. It's a letter about God. It's a letter to us. When God caused this to be written thousands of years ago, he had in mind you. He had in mind you on the 9th of October 2019 that you would be offered this. You would be offered this. What am I offering? I'm offering you eternal life. It's no small print, although you do have to follow Jesus. Yeah, you have to do that. That's what being doing a U-turn. But if you do, the Bible promises us this. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. Taste and see that the Lord is good. To be a Christian is the best decision I ever made. Facing death, I don't need anything other than Jesus Christ. I mean that. And Corrie ten Boom, who was a lady who was in a concentration camp for sheltering Jews in the Second World War, she was a Christian, she said this. We only know that Christ is all we need, and Christ is all we have. So Christ is all you need. But you don't need a promotion. You don't need a pay rise. No, you don't. You need Christ. And how do you find Christ? As you read this, I believe you will step off the page and into your life. May that be so. Thank you for listening, and I'm really happy to take questions. Thank you.